The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro. Part 2. Continued. The waiting was made harder by the lack of assurance that it would ever be rewarded. Rayburn could remember when, at 30, he had been the youngest congressman. He had still been young, 36 in 1918, when the waiting began. Now he was no longer so young. He passed 40, and then 45. And instead of growing closer, his goal seemed to be receding before him. After the 1928 elections, when Hoover beat Smith, there were only 165 Democrats left in the House to 269 Republicans. Never had the party's prospects of regaining control of the House seemed more remote. Nor, of course, would a Democratic victory in itself end Rayburn's waiting. He was not the first Democrat in line for the speakership. He was not even first within the Texas delegation. If the Democrats turned to Texas for a speaker, they would turn to the delegation's most powerful and most senior member, the popular Garner, who had been in Congress since 1902. If a Democratic victory did come to pass, moreover, would he still be in a position to take advantage of it? Would he still be in Congress? He had already had several close primary races, and it seemed to him, pessimistic as he was by nature, inevitable that he would one day lose. "My ambition has been to rise in the House," he wrote to one of his sisters in 1922. "But nobody can tell when the Democrats will come into power, and then a race every 2 years, they will finally get a fellow in a district." So many men had waited patiently for the tides of history to turn, and had been defeated before the turn came. Had been defeated, or had become ill, or had died. So many men who had once dreamed of rising to the Speaker's chair had died without achieving their ambition. Was he to be only one of these? Waiting was hard enough. He had to wait in silence. Seniority might one day lift him to the chairmanship of his committee. Seniority alone would never enable him to climb the triple dais. The Speaker was elected by a vote of the majority party, a vote based not only on seniority but on popularity, particularly among the party's influentials. He needed friends. He couldn't make enemies. He needed friends not only for his own dreams, but for the dreams he dreamed for what he had referred to as the large yet poor class. Even if he became committee chairman, even if he became speaker, the forces which would oppose him, the interests he hated, would be strong. If he wanted not just to hate them but to beat them, he would need allies among his colleagues. He would need, in fact, every ally, every friend he could get. The savagery with which he fought made enemies. He would have to stop fighting. Sam Rayburn, who had never bided his time, who had rushed to fight the oppressors of the people, was going to have to bide his time now. This man, who so hated to be licked, who said that being licked almost kills me, was going to have to take his lickings now, take them in silence. He waited. He had made so many speeches during his first 6 years in the House. During these next 12, he made so few. Entire sessions would pass without the representative of Texas's 4th congressional district taking the floor. And he was hardly more loquacious in private. He took to standing endlessly in the aisle at the rear of the House chamber, his elbows resting on the brass rail that separated the aisle from the rows of seats, greeting passing members courteously, listening attentively to their problems, but saying very little himself. If he was pressed to say something, his words would be so few as to be cryptic. Those 12 years were the years in which the legend of Sam Rayburn's taciturnity was born. The heavy lips compressed themselves into a thin, hard line, so grim that even in repose the corners of his mouth turned down. The Republicans passed legislation raising the tariffs again, helping the railroads. The lips of the railroad legislator remained closed. Men who had not known him before had no idea how much strength it took for him to keep them closed. When silent Cal Coolidge noted that, "You don't have to explain something you haven't said," Rayburn told people that that was the smartest thing he'd ever heard outside of the Bible. He took to quoting the remark himself. He talked sometimes about men who had gotten in trouble from talking too much. Was he reminding himself what he was doing, and why he had to do it? There was no more breaking of house customs, no more defiance of party leaders. He had disregarded Garner's advice once. Now he sought it, became the older Texan's protégé. His hotel, the Cochrane, was the Washington residence of many prominent members of the House. In the evenings they would pull up easy chairs in a circle in the lobby and talk. Rayburn made it his business to become part of that circle, a respectful, advice-asking, attentively listening part. If he felt he knew as much as they never knew it. In later years he would frequently quote a biblical axiom, "There is a time to fish and a time to mend nets." This was net-mending time for him, and he mended them. The House hierarchy came to look upon him with paternalistic fondness, and these older men learned that on the rare occasions on which Sam Rayburn did speak, there was quite a bit of sense in what he had to say. They saw, moreover, that he had what one observer was to call an indefinable knack for sensing the mood of the House. He seemed to know, by some intuitive instinct for the legislative process, just how far it could be pushed, what the vote on a crucial bill would be if the vote was taken immediately, and what it would be if the vote was delayed a week. Asked decades later about this knack, he would reply, "If you can't feel things that you can't see or hear, you don't belong here." He never discussed this knack then, or admitted he had it, but the older men saw he did, and the older men learned they could depend on him. Once he gave his word, it was never broken. Garner tendered him his ultimate accolade. "Sam stands hitched." Garner and other Democratic leaders admitted him to the inner circles of House Democrats, employed him, as one article put it, to do big jobs in tough fights, and were repaid by his hard-working loyalty. It was during these years that, when some young member asked him for advice on how to succeed in Congress, he began to use the curt remark, "To get along, go along." He used his growing influence to make friends among young congressmen, but the alliances thus struck were made very quietly. Recalls one congressman, "He would help you. If you said, 'Sam, I need help,' he might say, 'I'll see what I can do.' He might just grunt. But when the bill came up, if you had needed some votes changed, the votes were changed." More and more now, other congressmen turned to him. Said one, Marvin Jones, "The House soon spots the men who attend a committee session where there isn't any publicity, who attend during the long grind of hearing witnesses, who day after day have sat there. Men will come in and out of an executive session, but there are only a few men who sit there and watch every sentence that goes into the bill and know why it went in. The House soon finds out who does that on each committee." A congressman, required to vote on many bills he knows little about, learns to rely heavily on those few men, Jones was to say. "I could give you some of the names of those men. There was Sam Rayburn." To get along, go along. Wait, wait in silence. It was hard for him to take his own advice. How hard is revealed in the letters he wrote home. "This is a lonesome, dark day here," he wrote. "You wouldn't think it, but a fellow gets lonesomer here, I think, than any place almost. Everybody is busy, and one does not find that congeniality for which a fellow so thirsts. It is a selfish, sour-bellied place, every fellow trying for fame, perhaps I should say notoriety, and are ready at all times to use the other fellow as a prize-pole for it. I really believe I will here, as I did in the Texas legislature, rise to a place where my voice will be somewhat potent in the affairs of the nation. But sometimes it becomes a cheerless fight, and a fellow is almost ready to exclaim, 'What's the use?'" He wrote that letter in 1919. The cheerless fight had just started. He would have to fight it for 12 more years. But he fought. He took his own advice. He waited in silence, waited and went along for 12 years, acquiring not only seniority but friends, until on December 7, 1931, the day on which, thanks to Dick Clayburgh's election, the Democrats regained control of Congress, the day Lyndon Johnson came to Washington, he became not Speaker. It would be another 9 years before Sam Rayburn became Speaker, but chairman of the House Interstate Commerce Committee. One more year of waiting was required because of the general governmental paralysis during Herbert Hoover's last year in office. But on March 4, 1933, the new president was sworn in. And then, after all those years of waiting, Sam Rayburn showed what he had been waiting for. At Roosevelt's direction, legislation had been drafted giving the federal government authority to regulate the issuance of securities for the protection of those who bought them. Rayburn, who had seen so many financially unsophisticated farmers invest the little spare cash they had been able to scrape together in worthless stocks or bonds, had fought for similar legislation more than 20 years before, not only in Austin but in Washington. It was, of course, over his attempt to give the federal government authority over the issuance of railroad securities that the freshman congressman had defied Woodrow Wilson. That attempt had been unsuccessful, as had decades of populist outcry for meaningful federal legislation. In the face of Wall Street opposition, the most populists could get was state blue sky laws. The Texas law had, of course, been authored by the gentleman from Blanco County. But when he had made that attempt, Rayburn had been a junior member of the Interstate Commerce Committee. Now he was its chairman. There was uncertainty over which committee had jurisdiction over Roosevelt's proposed Truth in Securities Act, but Speaker Henry Rainey was a friend of Rayburn's. "I want it," Rayburn told him. Rainey gave it to him. His first difficulty was with the legislation itself, a poorly drafted bill, as confusing as the problems it was trying to solve, and almost completely lacking in any effective enforcement measures. Attempts to patch it up had been hamstrung by Roosevelt's reluctance to offend the man he had asked to draft it, an old Wilsonian Democrat, Houston Thompson, and since no one knew what to do, the measure seemed likely to die. Then Rayburn paid a visit to Raymond S. Moley, one of Roosevelt's advisers. Rayburn knew what to do, Moley was to recall. The bill was a hopeless mess, Rayburn said, and the patching up should stop. A new bill should be written from scratch, he said, and it should be written, under his direction, by new draftsmen, experts in the complicated securities field. Moley agreed with Rayburn's analysis, but felt he could not bring in new draftsmen unless he could find a way around Roosevelt's reluctance to ease out Thompson. Moley was unwilling to spell out the problem, but he found that he didn't have to. Before he went ahead on the draftsman business, he said, it would have to be understood that I was acting directly on his, Rayburn's, authorization, not the President's. For all his seeming slowness, there isn't much Sam misses. He laughed appreciatively. All right, he said, you've got it. On a Friday in early April, three young men began working on a new bill. A Harvard Law School professor, James M. Landis, and two lawyers expert in the securities field, Thomas G. Corcoran and Benjamin B. Cohen. On Monday, they presented their work to the Interstate Commerce Committee. Questions from the puzzled committee members about the immensely technical draft lasted all day. All day the committee's chairman sat silent. Trying to read his face for clues, the young men found none. They were discouraged. Moley had learned what lay behind the seeming slowness, but they hadn't. And to them Rayburn seemed, in Cohen's word, a countryman, incapable of understanding so complex a subject. At the end of the day, the chairman asked the young men to wait outside. After a while, he came out and told them that the committee had approved their work and wanted them to turn it into a finished bill. He said no more. Only later did Landis learn that it was Sam Rayburn who decided that this was a bill worth working on. Rayburn said he wanted them to work with a House legislative draftsman, Middleton Beeman. Beeman was a Rayburn man. I had thought I knew something of legislative draftsmanship until I met him, Landis was to say. For days, in his office, deep in the bowels of the old House office building, Beeman, a rough, tough guy, would not allow us to draft a line. He insisted instead on exploring the implications of the bill to find exactly what we did or did not have in mind. He probed. This was, Landis recalls, exasperating. The young men began to suspect that this delay bore symptoms of sinister Wall Street plotting. Rayburn's demeanor did not alleviate their suspicions. Dropping by Beeman's office, he would pick up a draft paragraph and stand there studying it. He didn't, Landis could see, know anything about securities, and they felt he didn't understand what he was reading. If he did, he certainly gave no sign of it. Sometimes he gave them a word or two of advice, but it was advice so simple, so unsophisticated, that they could hardly keep from laughing at it. He said that he wanted a strong bill, but he wanted to make sure it was right, that it was fair, that it was just, Cohen says. He gave no sign of approval, either. The grim face beneath the gleaming bald skull was as immobile as a mask. They didn't know what to make of him, this man of whom Beeman and Beeman's assistants and everyone else they talked to seemed so unaccountably afraid, but he certainly didn't seem to be on their side. Their suspicions were seemingly confirmed when Rayburn agreed to Wall Street demands that its representatives be given a hearing to present their views on the draft bill. Suspicion turned to apprehension when they heard that the street's views would be presented by three of its most prominent attorneys, led by the feared John Foster Dulles himself. They would have to rely for their defense on this slow, stolid farmer. And then came the hearing. "I confess that when I went in that morning to the hearing, I was scared," Landis was to recall. "After all, I was something of a youngster." The hearing was closed, and no records of it exist, but those who were there agree. Two men, John Foster Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, and Sam Rayburn of Bonham, were the principal antagonists. And the Dulles who stalked into that hearing room slunk out of it. And after the hearing, there came the moment that, Landis was to say, I'll never forget, the moment when he found out what was behind the mask. I went back to my little cubbyhole down in the sub-basement. About 20 minutes later, I got a call from Sam Rayburn to come up to his office. Well, naturally, I was worried. I thought maybe all our work was down the drain. But Rayburn said that the work was just fine, and that they should get right on with it. For the first time, there was an expression on Rayburn's usually expressionless face. It was a snarl. He began talking about Dulles and about Wall Street lawyers, and he cursed them in very obscene language. Now, Sam didn't know anything about securities, Landis was to say, recalling that meeting. But Sam was an expert on the integrity of people. He knew when a man was telling the truth. He had no patience for men who were not sincere and honest. And this is what he expressed to me at that time. He had not, Landis was to say, known Rayburn too well up to that time. I got to know him quite well later on. He was an expert in procedure. Oh, absolutely an expert in matters of procedure. He was an expert in procedure and sizing up the motives of what made human beings tick. An expert on human beings. With the full 24-member committee susceptible to Wall Street pressure, he delegated the Truth and Securities Bill to a subcommittee, the Right Subcommittee. As its chairman, he named himself. As its other four members, he named four congressmen he knew he could dominate, four who would bow to his personality rather than to Wall Street. When in the showdown they did, and reported the young men's bill favorably to the full committee, he told the young men which committee members to approach and how to approach them. Says Thomas Corcoran, whose expertise in handling men was to become legendary in Washington, "Sam was a genius in handling men. He would send you to see a guy, and he would tell you exactly what the guy was going to say, and in what order, and he'd tell you how to answer each point. And the guy would say exactly what Sam had told you he was going to say, and if you just answered exactly what Sam told you to answer, you could just see these conservative sons of bitches coming around right before your eyes." He told them which committee members not to bother approaching, because they would never come around. And these he handled in a different manner. His weapon was the gavel. And almost half a century later, the young men can still remember its harsh crash as their champion swung it in their defense. During the 100 days, his chairmanship was a temporary dictatorship, writes Michael E. Parrish in his Securities Regulation and the New Deal. Even under normal circumstances a powerful chairman, he dominated the committee as never before. Still other committee members didn't understand the incredibly complex bill with its pages of detailed technical regulations governing securities issuance, but they felt it was not necessary that they understand. Rayburn told them it was a good bill, and they trusted Sam. The hearings the committee held on the bill, before reporting it favorably to the full House, was so brief that Moley, years later, was to write incorrectly that none had been held. An expert in procedure. Oh, absolutely an expert in matters of procedure. The young men had anticipated problems in the full House because of the legislation's complexities. If you amended Section 7, it might have an effect on Section 2 and 13 and so on, Landis was to say. But thanks to Rayburn, the complexities made passage easier, not harder. As Landis recalls, because of its complexities and the danger that an unstudied amendment, apparently fair on its face, might unbalance the articulation of its various sections, the bill was introduced under a special rule that permitted the consideration of amendments only if they had the approval of the committee chairman. No such approval was forthcoming. Landis, watching with apprehension from the gallery, saw that Rayburn had complete control of the situation. To his astonishment, the bill passed with scarcely a murmur of dissent. The young men had anticipated more problems, all but insoluble problems, in the conference committee, in which 5-member delegations from the House and the Senate met to try to reconcile their conflicting versions of the same bill, for the Senate bill was in effect Houston Thompson's original hopeless bill, which was thoroughly approved by the distinguished chairman of the Senate delegation, Duncan U. Fletcher of Florida. But there were procedures for a conference committee also. Few men knew them. If they exist, and documentary evidence to that effect is to be found in Hines' precedents, they are observed as much in breach as in conformance, Landis was to write years later, after he had become a veteran of conference committees. But one of the men who knew them was Sam Rayburn. Taking advantage of them was made easier because Fletcher, a courtly southern gentleman, suggested that Rayburn be chairman for the first meeting. Rayburn said that the first question to be decided was, as Landis put it, what document, House version or Senate version, you would work from, which was a very important issue, really a basic issue. Rayburn quietly asked Senator Fletcher if he did not desire to make a motion on this matter. Apparently unaware of the trap into which he was walking, the 75-year-old Fletcher replied that he certainly did so desire. He moved that the Senate bill be made the working draft. "Motion moved," Rayburn said quickly. "Motion seconded?" It was seconded. "Vote on the motion." The vote was, of course, a tie. All 5 Senate members voted in favor of the motion. All 5 House members voted against it. Since it was a tie, Rayburn said, the motion was lost. Consequently, the House bill would become the basic draft. Had a House member made the motion and a tie vote resulted, as of course it would have, the Senate bill would have become the basis for negotiations. By luring a senator into making the motion, Rayburn had won a crucial point before the conferees had more than settled into their seats. Except for an occasional reference to its provisions, Landis was to reminisce, that was the last we heard of the Senate bill. The Senate delegation included not only Fletcher, but such big names as Carter Glass of Virginia, James Cousins of Michigan, and Hiram Johnson of California. The House had no such distinguished personalities except for Sam Rayburn, Landis was to say. But that one was enough. While Fletcher had apparently intended that at succeeding meetings he and Rayburn would alternate in the chair, he was too much of a gentleman to put himself forward. And as Landis puts it, absent any request from him, Rayburn continued to guide the proceedings. Aides were guided with an iron hand. Once, desperate because their handiwork was being ignored, 2 Senate staffers who had worked on the Thompson bill attempted to put their draft in front of the committee members. Rayburn spoke to them, in Landis's phrase, rudely but firmly. The attempt was not repeated. Senators were guided with deference, deference in tone, in solicitation of their opinions, in all matters except matters of substance. The atmosphere of most conference committees is tense, Landis was to write. In this committee, thanks to Rayburn's guidance, and the respect he showed for everyone's opinions, friendships developed, and the tension dissolved. And so did the opposition. On every crucial point, the final bill was the House bill. On May 27, 1933, Roosevelt signed it into law, and after decades of fruitless discussion, government regulation of the issuance of securities was a reality. In the public mind, Rayburn was associated hardly at all with the dramatic months immediately after Roosevelt's inauguration, during which so much legislation that was to change the shape of American life was rushed through Congress. But to the young men who had seen what he did, he was one of the heroes of the 100 days. The next year brought the introduction of legislation for governmental regulation of the exchanges on which securities were traded. Tough as the fight had been in 1933, the fight in 1934 for the creation of a Securities and Exchange Commission and an end to the operation of the Stock Exchange as a private club, run by and for the benefit of its members, often at the expense of the public, was tougher. The business community moved against Rayburn in his own committee and almost beat him there. He had to use every ounce of persuasiveness he possessed, and every lever of power, to break the revolt in the committee. Then, in angry scenes on the House floor, he compromised and compromised and compromised again, and never compromised on the crucial point. He maneuvered like a master in another conference committee, and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 joined the Securities Act of 1933 on the nation's statute books. 1935 was the year of the Public Utilities Bill. The bill was to curb the power of giant utility holding companies over their operating subsidiaries. To populists, these holding companies symbolized the entrenched economic power of the Northeast and its effect on the people throughout the country. Electric rates were unjustly high for consumers, and particularly for farmers, because of the siphoning off of local power companies' cash by the holding companies up in New York. Electricity was unavailable to most farmers because the decision-makers in New York, interested only in profit potential, saw too little in rural electrification. For decades, populist legislators had attempted to enact state legislation to curb utilities, and had been defeated in almost every significant attempt by the utilities' awesome power in state capitals. As a member of the Texas state legislature 20 years before, Rayburn himself had fought unsuccessfully against them. Rayburn knew now that only the power of the federal government could curb the power of the holding companies, and now, at last, there was a president who knew it too. As governor of New York, Roosevelt had fought these giants in their lair and had lost. The president demanded, and Corcoran and Cohen drafted, and Rayburn and Senator Burton K. Wheeler, the old populist from Montana, introduced legislation that included a clause, dubbed the Death Sentence Clause, which gave the Securities and Exchange Commission power to compel the dissolution of holding companies. The mere mention of lobbyists brought the deep red flush to Rayburn's head. Wrote a friend, "He hates them with a venomous hatred." 1935 was the year of the utility lobby. "You talk about a labor lobby," Roosevelt said. "Well, it is a child compared to this utility lobby. You talk about a Legion lobby. Well, it is an infant in arms compared to this utility lobby." "This was," he said, "the most powerful, dangerous lobby that has ever been created by any organization in this country." The lobbyists played dirty. It was during the death sentence fight that there began the first widespread whispers that the president was insane. And they played rough. The flood of almost 1 million messages that inundated congressmen was reinforced by the threat direct. Congressmen were told bluntly that money, as much as was needed, would be poured into their districts to defeat them in the next election if they voted for the Public Utilities Act. This time, Rayburn's control of his committee was broken. When, after 6 weeks of bitter hearings, the bill was reported out, it came to the floor with the death sentence provision removed and the bill emasculated. "I hate to be licked. It almost kills me." 3 times, against the wishes of congressional leaders of his own party, Rayburn demanded a roll call on the death sentence. He had the White House on his side. On Roosevelt's orders, Corcoran was working tirelessly beside him. And Senator Hugo Black's hearings were providing the White House with new ammunition as they revealed that the utilities had spent $1.5 million to generate the spontaneous mailings, which had actually been produced by using names picked broad-scale from telephone directories. But in Texas, newspapers were calling him a communist and accusing him of trying to murder a great enterprise. John W. Carpenter, president of Texas Power and Light, asked a banker in Rayburn's district to estimate how much it would cost to beat Sam Rayburn. He said they had the money to do anything. With a storm of abuse rising about him in the House chamber, and with Carpenter and other utility executives sitting in the House gallery, their presence a silent warning to the congressman, he lost all 3 roll call votes by overwhelming margins. But there was still the conference committee. No friends were made in this one. So bitter did feelings run during its 2 months of meetings that other members barred Cohen and Corcoran, the bill's drafters, from the committee room. But the bill that emerged from the conference, and that was passed, while far short of what Roosevelt and Rayburn had originally hoped for, nonetheless contained the mandate they wanted for the SEC to compel holding companies' reorganization. Sam Rayburn issued a rare public statement. With the Securities Act of 1933, the Stock Exchange Act of 1934, and this holding company bill to complete the cycle, I believe that control is restored to the government and the people, and taken out of the hands of a few, and that the American people will have cause to believe that this administration is trying and is establishing a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Rayburn received little credit at the time for his role in the passage of this legislation. Few people, if they depend on the public prints for their information, know much about him, the New York Times noted. It is doubtful if there is any member of his ability who is less conspicuous, less self-heralded, and less known outside the influential group with which he is immediately in contact. And he has received little credit from history, in part because he left almost no record of his deeds in writing. Not in memoirs, not even in memos. As David Halberstam says, he did all his serious business in pencil on the back of a used envelope. When asked how he remembered what he had promised or what he had said, he would growl, "I always tell the truth, so I don't need a good memory to remember what I said." In part because, shy, he shrank from publicity. "Let the other fella get the headlines," he said. "I'll take the laws." It is possible to read detailed histories of the New Deal and find hardly a reference to Sam Rayburn. Occasionally, when he was old, he would refer to what he had done. In 1955, Drew Pearson was interviewing him about the regulatory commissions, when Rayburn suddenly blurted out, "I was in on the borning of every one of those commissions. I wrote the law that passed the Federal Communications Commission and the Securities and Exchange Commission. I wrote the law for the Civil Aeronautics Board." But the people to whom he was speaking would not usually understand what the old man was talking about. During the Eisenhower administration, a young congressional aide was expounding on the brilliance of John Foster Dulles when Rayburn suddenly said, "I cut him to pieces once, you know." "What do you mean?" the aide asked. "When was that?" The old man grunted and refused to answer. But his name is on the Securities Act of 1933, the Fletcher-Rayburn Act, and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, the Fletcher-Rayburn Act, and the Public Utilities Act of 1935, the Wheeler-Rayburn Act, and on other pieces of New Deal legislation that, for a while at least, took control out of the hands of a few and restored it to the people. And those who fought beside him knew what he had done. SEC Chairman William O. Douglas was to recall that, "We called it affectionately the Sam Rayburn Commission, since he had fathered it." The three great pieces of legislation embodied principles for which the People's Party, the party of the great orators, Bryan and Tom Watson and old Joe Bailey, had been fighting for half a century. But the populist perhaps most responsible for the achievement represented by their collective passage was the least eloquent of populists, the man who had achieved the power to bring their dreams to realization not by speeches, but by silence. Rayburn, of course, gave credit to someone else, in his own quiet way. Although over the course of his many years in Washington, autographed photographs of many notables adjoined the pictures of Robert E. Lee on his office walls, in his home back in Bonham, resting on his desk, there was, after all these years, still only one picture, the picture of Sam Rayburn's first hero. But now, when Congress adjourned and he came home and unpacked his suitcase, he lifted out of the suitcase and placed beside the picture of Robert E. Lee a picture of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Even before he had attained power, Sam Rayburn, with his grim face beneath the gleaming bald head, had been a formidable figure. Now there was power behind the presence, substantial power. The committee chairmanship as well as patronage on the grand scale, for he had been given not only the naming of some commissioners and top staff members of the new regulatory agencies, but a voice in the White House dispensation of patronage to other congressmen. A columnist noted that while his aversion to publicity made him a man in the shadows, he was one of the handful of congressmen who made the wheels go around in the House. Roosevelt allowed him, for example, to name one of the commissioners of both the Federal Communications Commission and the Interstate Commerce Commission. The full force of his personality, held under check so long, was unleashed at last. On the issues he cared deeply about, he was immovable. "If you were arguing with him and raised a point, he'd give you an answer," says a fellow congressman. "If you raised the point again, you'd get the same answer again. The exact same answer. You realized that was the conclusive remark. That was the end of that conversation." He almost never raised his voice, and he never threatened. The most he might say, in a low, mild, almost gentle tone, was, "Before you go on here, I want to tell you this. You are about to make a mistake, a very big mistake." And he never asked for anything, a vote or a favor, more than once. If you turned Sam Rayburn down once, men learned, he would never ask you again for anything. He would never ask a man to do anything against his own interests. "A congressman's first duty is to get reelected," he would say, and he would advise young congressmen, "always vote your district." If a congressman said that a vote Rayburn was asking for would hurt him in his district, Rayburn would always accept that excuse. But Rayburn knew the districts, and if the excuse wasn't true, Rayburn's rage would rise. Once, for example, it erupted against a congressman from a liberal district who took orders from the district's reactionary business interests only because he didn't want to offend them. The congressman had often used the excuse of public opinion in his district, and because Rayburn had never challenged him on it and had stopped asking for his support, was under the misapprehension that Rayburn believed that excuse. One evening, however, after the congressman had voted against a bill Rayburn supported, he approached Rayburn, who was standing with a group of friends, and with a winning smile said he sure wished he could have voted with him, but that such a vote would have hurt him in his district. Rayburn did not reply for a long moment, while the deep red flush started to creep up his head. "Then," says one of the men who were standing with Rayburn, in a recollection confirmed by another, Rayburn said, "Now, I never asked for your vote on this bill. I never said a word to you about this bill. I knew you wouldn't vote for this bill, and I never said a word to you about it. But you came across the room just now and told me you wish you could have voted with me. So I'm going to tell you something now. You could have voted with me. I've known that district since before you were born, and that vote wouldn't have hurt you one bit, not one bit. You didn't vote with me because you didn't have the guts to." The flush on the huge head was so dark now that it looked almost black. The men standing with Rayburn backed away. "So don't you come crawling across the room telling me you wish you could have voted for the bill, 'cause it's a damn lie. It's a damn lie. And you're a damn liar. You didn't vote for the bill 'cause you didn't have the guts to. You've got no guts. Let me tell you something. I didn't raise the issue, but you did. You came across the room, so let me tell you something. The time is coming when the people are going to find out that all you represent is the Chamber of Commerce. And when they find that out, they're going to beat your ass." A young state legislator who had considered challenging the congressman for his seat had dropped the idea because he didn't have enough political clout. Not a week after his confrontation with Rayburn, the congressman walked into the House dining room for lunch and saw the legislator sitting there at Rayburn's table. When the legislator returned home, he had all the clout he needed, and the congressman's political career was over. Rayburn drove him not only out of Congress, but out of Washington. He tried to stay on in the Capitol, looking for a government job or a lobbying job, but no job was open to him, and none would ever be, not as long as Sam Rayburn was alive. The temper, backed by the political power, made men afraid of Rayburn. They tried to gauge his moods. When he would say, "Sheet," drawing the word out, I knew he was still good-natured, recalls House doorkeeper Fishbait Miller. But if he said it fast, like, "I don't want to hear a lot of shit from you," I knew I was in trouble. Some congressmen, says House Sergeant-at-Arms Kenneth Harding, were literally afraid to start talking to him. Says Harding, "He could be very friendly, but if he was frowning, boy, stay away. I mean, if he was coming down a corridor and he was frowning, people were literally afraid to start talking to him. They feared to get close to him. They were afraid of saying the wrong thing." And if the great heavy head wore not only a frown but that dark red flush, when he came down a corridor it was a stone through a wave. People would part before him. But if men who saw Sam Rayburn only in the halls of Congress feared him, Men who also saw him outside those halls pitied him. As a child, loneliness had been what he dreaded most. "Loneliness breaks the heart," he had said. "Loneliness consumes people." Now he was a man who had attained the power he had so long sought, but he had learned that even power could not save him from what he dreaded. During the hours in which Congress was in session, of course, he was surrounded by people wanting to talk to him, clamoring for his attention, hanging on his every word. But Congress wasn't always in session. It wasn't in session in the evenings or on weekends. And when Congress wasn't in session, Sam Rayburn was often alone. He had wanted so desperately not to be alone. He had wanted a family, a wife and children. Driving through the Washington suburbs with a friend, not long after he first arrived in the Capitol, he had said as they passed the Chevy Chase Country Club, "I want a house that big." And when the friend asked him why, he said, "For all my children." Adults, another friend says, were scared of Rayburn, but children weren't. They took to him instinctively. They crawled all over him and rubbed their hands over his bald head. He would sit talking to a little girl or boy for hours, with a broad, gentle grin on that great, hard face to which, it sometimes seemed, no man could bring a smile. Friends who saw Sam Rayburn with women realized that his usual grim demeanor concealed, that in fact the grimness was a mask deliberately donned to conceal, a terrible shyness and insecurity. He was always afraid of looking foolish. He would never tell a joke in a speech because, he said, "I tried to tell a joke once in a speech, and before I got through, I was the joke." And this fear seemed accentuated when he was with women. He had fallen in love once with the beautiful, dark-haired 18-year-old sister of another Texas congressman, his friend Marvin Jones. Rayburn was 36 at the time. Although he wrote Metsy Jones regularly, 9 years passed before he asked her to marry him. Friends say it took him that long to work up the nerve. And when, in 1927, when Rayburn was 45, they finally became engaged, he asked her to make the engagement short. "I was in a great hurry to get married before she changed her mind," he wrote a friend. The marriage lasted 3 months. Rayburn never spoke of what had happened. So tight-lipped was he on the subject that most men who met him in later years never learned he had been married. Once, when he was an old man, he was talking to a group of Girl Scouts, one of whom asked why he wasn't married. "Oh, I'm so cranky that nobody would have me," he said. "I'll marry you," one of the girls said. Rayburn laughed. Fishbait Miller, who knew about the marriage, and working with Rayburn for 30 years, he learned things about Rayburn despite Rayburn, says that even after Metsy remarried, Rayburn kept watch over her from a distance. When her daughter from the second marriage contracted polio, the girl was admitted immediately to the famed polio treatment center at Warm Springs, despite the long waiting list. "It is true that someone can be powerful and you can feel very sorry for him," Miller says. "I felt sorry for Rayburn because he lost the woman he loved." For years thereafter, Rayburn had not a single date. He may, in fact, never have had more than a few scattered dates. No one really knows. After Metsy left him, Sam Rayburn was alone. He moved into 2 rooms in a small, rather dingy apartment house near DuPont Circle, where he lived for the rest of his life. He could, of course, have gone to parties, but his belief that he could not make small talk, his fear that he would make a fool of himself if he tried, made parties an ordeal. This book is continued on cassette number 5, side 1.